vowing to make it safe.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Doug Krisner. Being the parent of a young child these days means worrying about contaminated toys. Ever since Mattel's massive recall of Chinese-made products with dangerously high levels of lead. Today, the head of China's Product Safety Agency pledged to resolve problems in time for the holidays. The U.S. and China signed an agreement yesterday banning the use of lead paint on toys for the American market. But in Brazil, they're not taking any chances. The country's banned imported products from Mattel until the government looks at whether the company's abiding by safety regulations. China's a low-cost labor magnet for manufacturing. But today, an interesting twist. A Chinese machinery maker is expected to announce plans to build a new $60 million plant in Georgia. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Sany Heavy Industry Company would be the first Chinese firm to manufacture construction equipment in the U.S. But you might wonder, isn't it cheaper for them to build their products in China?
It's not about the cost of manufacturing, really. It's more about having the product available and also having product support.
That's Dennis Slater, president of the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. It's an industry, he says, where you need a local presence in order to compete.
I think the Chinese recognize the U.S. market in North America being one of the biggest markets for construction equipment. If they're going to be a world player, they have to enter this market here.
More Chinese manufacturers are expected to follow. As for the impact on homegrown construction equipment companies, Slater says American firms are very competitive and produce more than they can sell in the U.S. market. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wall Street had the blinders on yesterday. Forget the problems in the credit markets and forget the possibility of recession. The bet was all about the Fed lowering interest rates, not once, but many times. So the major indexes each gained about 1.5%. Volume, though, was on the light side, and that can exaggerate things a bit. Even so, the Dow jumped 180 to 13,308. The S&P added nearly 20 to 1,471. And the NASDAQ was higher by 38 to 2,597. Overnight in Tokyo, the Nikkei fell when Japan's prime minister unexpectedly resigned. And in Europe this morning, the major markets are moving lower. Crude oil prices are trading at near record levels this morning, even though OPEC announced yesterday it was putting more crude onto the world oil market. Stephen Beard reports from London.
Traders say that OPEC's planned increase of 500,000 barrels a day is too little to make much of a difference. Global demand is still soaring. Stockpiles are running low. Even the possibility of recession in the U.S. and a downturn in American demand have failed to curb the price of crude. That, says analyst Michael Hughes, is because emerging economies like those of China and India still have an insatiable need for energy.
These developing countries aren't slowing down, so the demand-supply balance is going to remain pretty acute, and hence people are forecasting oil prices of over $90.
But those members of OPEC who argued for no increase in output say a U.S. downturn could be more severe than expected, which might hit the emerging economies too, undermining their demand for oil. And that could bring oil prices down with a bump. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Officials in Alaska have some burning questions for British Petroleum. BP has had 4 fires in just over a month at its North Slope oil production facility. And authorities want to know why. BP has had some other problems in Alaska, too. Last year, more than 200,000 gallons of crude leaked at the Prudhoe Bay field due to corrosion in a pipeline. The field was partially shut down months later when a second leak was discovered. But BP says these recent fires are separate events and not part of any pattern.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. By the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators, with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers.
When you kick back at a bar or a restaurant, there's usually music playing in the background. Well, those venues are supposed to shell out a license fee for those songs. Copyright law says songwriters deserve a cut whenever a business plays their work in public. But not all business owners seem to agree. And that's sparking some lawsuits, as Ashley Milntight reports.
Businesses that don't pay up could be saddled with fines as high as $150,000. Vincent Candelora is with the American Society of Composers, Authors and Publishers, or ASCAP. He says ASCAP only sues venues after it spent months appealing to the owners.
We discuss and educate them as to how we arrive at the rates. We talk about the value that music has in their business. And in these instances, the business owners decided that they were simply going to ignore us.
The license fee venue owners pay depends on factors like how many seats the venue has and whether the music is played live or on CD. Rates vary from $300 a year up into the thousands. Ben owns a bar in Brooklyn. He hasn't bought a license fee for the music he plays.
I would not have $300 at the end of the year to pay them. No, no way.
Big nightclubs tend to regard the fees as a cost of doing business, but some small bar owners like Ben say they already pay hefty amounts in taxes and other fees to keep their places running. Ben says forcing them to cough up a license fee is unfair.
I guess I just don't think I should. I mean, if I bought the music, I own that CD, why can't I play it in my establishment if I own the establishment?
But Grammy-winning songwriter Gordon Chambers says the fee is fair. Unlike recording artists, songwriters aren't paid in advance, and they can't rake in money from performances or merchandise.
You get paid a cut when the album sells, and the way it really works down is to pennies.
9 cents per song, to be precise. That money can add up when an album sells, but Chambers says illegal music downloads have cut into album sales.
Because records are selling less and less, as songwriters, we're more and more reliant on those performance royalties to have a way of seeing an income on a song.
Some small business owners may object to paying the license fees, but Chambers says self-employed songwriters are small businesses too, and many of them are going out of business. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Doug Krisner. Thanks for listening. Make it a good day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.